Hi, everyone, and welcome to, I was about to say, ABC's Around the Theater. Damn, here we go.
That's his other podcast.
The plug.
The plug.
In fact, you should leave that for the natural chat, because obviously it's been quite a while since we've done this podcast, the Anesthesia Coffee Break.
So I've just really messed that up. Anyway, hi, everyone. This is Anesthesia Coffee Break. I'm Lahiri. I've got Stan here and also Christine. We've got a special episode with Christine. She's passed her exam and done extremely well. And I'm going to give it over to Stan to introduce her. So go for it, Stan.
Yeah, so look, Christine is very special to my heart because obviously she's a patron. And when she joined, she's a mum with kids and she'll tell you her story. And honestly, I did not even know half the story that she went through before she actually set the exam in March. And all throughout the whole process, I always thought that she was, you know, one of the top performers in the exam. And rightly so, she actually scored a merit in the exam. And I think what makes this story even more exciting and probably resonates for a lot of trainees is a lot of the hurdles that she went through prior to sort of sitting the exam. So, you know, Christine, you could just give us a short intro in terms of who you are, where you are, and your experience. I know it's a very open question, but feel free to start off.
Try to keep it short and snappy. So I am a BT2 trainee on the Central Coast of New South Wales. I live in Sydney, so I have a commute of about 2.5 to 3.5 hours on the road every day. I'm very importantly a mother of 3 children under 7, and I'm also an ex-ED advanced trainee. So I've been around the block a little bit, and as Sam said, I recently sat and passed the Part 1, which was an experience in itself, and I was lucky enough to receive a merit prize. I guess leading up to the exam, 6 or 7 weeks before the written, I fell just wasn't paying attention and fell. I broke my ankle and then I failed a period of conservative management and so ended up requiring an ORF and stabilisation about 4 or 5 weeks before the written component, and had a little bit of a complicated post-operative period and so lost just a lot of time with that initial injury and then post-operatively. So I would not describe being non-weight-bearing on crutches, needing to elevate my leg during the written as ideal, but somehow managed and surprisingly actually did quite well. So I think some of the preparation that I had done leading up to that 6-7 weeks before the injury must have really counted. And I guess even taking a little bit of time off prior to the written to just get my mind right was probably the right thing to do as well.
And Christine, you know, having that accident so close to the exam, I know you sort of touched on the idea that you were considering pulling out of the exam. Yeah. Like, you know, talk us through that decision process, how you decided, you know, whether you should or you shouldn't. And in the end, you just went, look, I'm just going to go for it. Like, talk us through what was going through. Yeah.
So I guess there are a few things. So I had found at my training network that there were quite a large group of us sitting the exam. And I've always been quite pro engaging in group study as much as possible. It's not my norm. I actually historically am a fairly solitary studier, but I thought with this exam, it's hard to understand the standard. It's impossible to know sometimes where you're at. So at least accessing the cohort to see where you're sitting amongst your trainees that are closest to you gave me an idea of how I was performing. So that was one thing. So I was able to do a little bit of self-assessment across a group. The other thing was these online tutes. Like, I was a Patreon member. I actually joined late. So I joined because of the injury, because I could no longer attend teaching in any form. I couldn't drive. I couldn't leave the house. So I joined and logged into anything that I could online. And that was like quite meaningful to me to be able to do that and engage in a way that everyone was engaging. So just being able to access a larger cohort was really useful to me too. And I have to say, I received a number of phone calls after the injury from very well-meaning people, but people that I guess are not super informed, to encourage me to defer my sitting just out of concern. And I know where they were coming from. They were saying that you don't want to put too much pressure on yourself. You've had this happen inside your hands. And if you need to defer, you defer, and that's fine. And they were encouraging me to take that option. But in retrospect, it was really important for me to rely on a few individual access points who were always very encouraging of me. Because I guess in a time of doubt, it's not useful to necessarily access the naysayers. So there were people around me that had been with me the whole way and who knew how I was performing, even when I wasn't necessarily able to assess that myself, who really encouraged me to just sit and just rely on the fact that you've done, you know, 12 months of prep, even regardless of the 6 weeks before the exam.
Yep, yep. I think that's the really hard thing. Now, before I get sort of louder sort of comment, but I do want to touch on the idea that I think as mentors, even for myself, I do struggle with the idea in terms of, you know, being encouraging, but also, you know, letting trainees know as well that, you know, they've got permission to as well if they want to consider sitting, you know, delaying their sitting. And for me, that's really difficult. And I think it's really interesting to hear your viewpoint. And I think for us, we never want to come across as negative, but we always want to be supportive. We want to make sure that you've got a very positive learning environment. And and Lara, I don't know about your experience and what your thoughts on that are.
Actually, Kristen, yeah, and just so everyone knows, like, did you do the normal kind of, I guess, preparation that us Victorians would do, which is like, we should do like 9 to 12 months, 20 hours a week, 1,000 hours? Was that the kind of?
I did do 12 months, I would say, and I had to go back and count the months to think about this, but I think I probably did 6 months of really proper study. And it took me the first 3 months to ramp up and then 3 months to get my day-to-day life in order to facilitate a full solid 6 months. But I think I did at least 1,000 hours. I would say that I possibly did more. So yes, I did the traditional route, I suppose, yeah.
And your kids, you know, having 3 kids, obviously a busy family. What's the structure of how you made all of that work?
It's bad. So my husband is a medic as well. So he's doing some, you know, extra fellowship time in interventional radiology. So he's really busy. He's not around. He works well over one FTE. So it took me 6 months, like that first 6 months, to really find a way with him to just manage, because I have been the primary parent for this entire period, and to relinquish that after, you know, my eldest was 7, to try to give that away with a 6-year-old who's used to a certain standard of living, it was hard. So the first 3 months, I just tried to facilitate study when I could. And I think a lot of people need that ramp up period where they get used to sitting down and just hitting the books. And then the second 3 months, I remember distinctly in June or July last year, having a conversation with my supervisor training and just saying, I can't find the time. I just can't, like a day off in between the drop-offs and everything else. I have about 3 or 4 hours and that's it. And she just said to me, being pragmatic, she just said, you just have to make changes. And so I did. So I relinquished all non-essential childcare duties, so all drop-offs and pickups, all school events, all play dates, all everything for 6 months. And I only held on to the things that I considered to be non-negotiable, so study, work, and being present for the kids when I felt they needed it. So if they'd had a hard day, a hard week, or had some sort of conflict or something, that was when I was present. And that would be any time. So I remember doing, you know, mock exams online and the kids coming in needing me for something, and I would just have to stop for 2 minutes and have a chat with them. But otherwise, all of the non-essential priorities had to fall away. It just wasn't possible otherwise.
And just to clarify, Christine, because I really love your honesty about it, because it's, you know, I think people don't always know what people have to do and sacrifice to get the exam. So like on a given day, was your time with your kids, you know, minutes or maybe an hour or like literally?
So when I work, because of my commute, I rarely see the children on the days that I work. So I leave the house quite early and I'm back, you know, around bedtime or past bedtime, and I prefer not to disturb them. So I actually, some of my kids made adjustments for me. I noticed that my younger one would literally have like a little sonar thing happening at 5 o'clock in the morning, and she'd hear the floorboards creak and she'd be like, I'm up, and she'd come and spend 10 minutes with me getting ready or something. So minutes, I would say, on the days that I work. On the days that I wasn't working, it would be in the vicinity of 30 to 60 minutes, I reckon, is when I would see them. And that would be probably around bedtime. Yeah, there'd be a wind down period that I would spend with them.
And did you have to get yourself out of the house? Because I can't imagine.
I couldn't get out of the house leading up to the exam because I was immobile, but I studied at upstairs. We have like a little attic that I can just close the door and pretend I'm not there. So, and We also moved house end of last year. That was a bad idea. I wouldn't discourage that. But in my old home, I used to have this downstairs basement area. So I used to do the whole fanfare where I'd be like, bye, I'm going to work, go out the front door. And then I'd sneak in the back door so they wouldn't know that I was there. And then I would just hide downstairs. So I would hide in the house, or they would go to school and go away for a period, or I would leave. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So these are the two big adversities, really, having to kind of give up that time with the kids. And you've had your injury. I mean, how did you cope with, you know, we talk about adversity, but it sounds like, you know, you've done well through it and everything, but how did you is it always been a thing? So strategies for coping with adversity, has it always been a thing? What are the things that you could kind of,
It was quite demoralizing, the injury. Like that was pretty demoralizing. And I think everyone sitting this exam has a sense of having to sacrifice a lot of their freedom in order to facilitate the study they need to do. And then to not be able to leave the house or drive or walk was just a bit, it was like salt in the wound. It was quite demoralizing.
Yeah.
I think around the time of the injury, it was quite important for me to just take a bit of time off. And as I said, I had to get my mind right before I could do any more work. And so I remember sitting in the emergency department waiting for a cast to go on, and my husband was like, just take a couple of weeks off, you know, just take a few weeks off, get your pain under control, get yourself okay on the crutches, and then get back into it. And I was like, I can't take 2 weeks off. I can't. that's not a thing. How dare you? But I did. I probably took a full week off where I didn't do anything. I didn't touch anything. And I just lay horizontal and put my leg up at 90 degrees for a lot of the day and watched a bit of TV. And I needed that to get myself back into a state where I felt able to tolerate just content.
Yes.
The other thing that I think I had to do was to identify ways in which I could study effectively, because I have to say, after the injury and then having ORF and then not having a good, you know, all of that was just like, it was a bit of a beating to morale. And I found it quite hard to sit down and just absorb information in the way that I had been doing. So I thought, and I found the most efficient way for me to study was to do very active forms of recollection in short bursts. So some days for me, that was like literally printing out 15, like generating it on Mac 95 and printing out 15 questions and just doing reading time like six times and seeing 15 times six and just doing that. And then having a quick read through the questions that I struggled with and just saying that'll do, like, and I couldn't do any more. And the other things that I did a lot more of was I did more past papers, because sitting down for 2 hours or 3 hours and just writing and just having to focus that period and then spending, you know, a leisurely whatever reviewing it. Those are the things that I had to do to just gear my mind up. And I think that, you know, everyone goes through ebbs and flows in their study. There are periods of high motivation and low motivation and productivity and, you know, low productivity. But I really think that the high-intensity, active recollection, short-burst study was very important for me during those low productivity periods, and particularly in that sort of few weeks before the exam.
That's really good advice, especially now with the training actually leading up to their exam. They're probably about a week and a half away. Christine, I want to touch on the point where, you know, your lowest point where you felt quite demoralized, and probably, I guess, the outlook in terms of, you know, your thoughts were, oh no, you know, some of the thoughts I'm sure you're going through is, you know, will I pass the exam? What's going to happen? Do I need to delay? And talk us through, like, was it a gradual upside in terms of, you know, sort of that, look, I can do this? Or was there like something like a moment where you went, look, at the end of the week, you're like, look, that's enough. Let's get going. You know, like what was it?
I think it was a little bit of the second one. I had a week and then I just went, okay, well, better get started. I better get back into it. And again, sitting down and trying to do what I had been doing and it not working, like that's quite, what's the word? Alarming, isn't it? 5 weeks ago, wow, I cannot do what I was doing. And I had this feeling before the injury that I was really ramping before that 2 months before the exam. I felt in myself that I was really ramping up to the exam and that I was on kind of a good trajectory. And then, you know, that all just had to stop. So, that, I mean, that was a little bit of an adjustment mentally and cognitively to just go, well, I cannot do what I was doing. I'm just not, I'm not getting it. And just having to switch modalities in a way. So there was a bit of that, oh, look, it's been a week. That's enough. Just get up and do something. It doesn't have to be the same. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be something. And again, after the ORF, and then I spent a couple of weeks like in bed after that. I wasn't very well. And so I got out of bed almost for the first time 2 weeks before the written. And I just said, I just have to do something, just something. And so something. I did.
And what can I ask you, what motivates you? Because, you know, this requires that, I guess, that inspiration to sort of go, right, I'm doing this, I'm changing this because of, you know, whatever reason. What motivates you? What drives you?
I think I wish I could tell you something inspirational, but I think for me, sometimes a little bit of that fear of failure is a
real
true motivator for me. I don't want to fail. I don't want to feel dumb. I don't want to look bad in front of people. All of those things that everyone experiences, I think, motivate, like, and some of that imposter syndrome, like, it motivates me heavily.
Yes.
Just wanting to appear successful. And that's not necessarily a good thing, but it is a real thing.
It's a real thing. I 100% agree. And I feel it. And even Lara and I talk about it all the time.
And the other thing is the kids, like the family, they've given up. They had given up a lot for me, you know, 6 to 12 months of change in routine, change in expectations, almost complete absence of me. I didn't want it to be for nothing. And it's not to say that if you don't get through the exam, it is for nothing. It's not at all. Like, that preparation is very important, and it gets you ready for the next go. Do you know what I mean? But I just, if I could do it and not have to put them through it for another 6 months, that was the choice that I made.
Did you float the idea with them?
Yeah.
There was a possibility. And what was their response?
So my husband is great. And like, I supported him through his fellowship, and I made a lot of lifestyle and career sacrifices to get him through his exams. So he was just like, okay, whatever. It's good. Oh. Like, it's fine. Like, you know, you've done your best. And he's like, you've done your best. I've seen you. You've done your best. And this has happened. And if it's out of your hands, that's how it is. And it's not a big deal. Yeah. My elder two were the same. They were like, oh, okay, it's fine. But my younger one, a bit of a, she's, how do I put this without sounding too judgmental?
Bit more in tune. Yeah.
She's a little bit more challenging. And she was at that age, you know, she was 3 when I started studying, and she was really, that's a really tricky age, I feel like, for girls. And she regressed a lot when I started studying, and particularly because she was a COVID baby. So she was really just attached to me the first 3 years of her life. Yeah. So she was not happy, but you know, she's 3, what can we expect? But in fact, my younger one, like, she was possibly a bit too young to get it. Like, when I passed, my L2 were like, oh, that's great. So over weekends you'll be free, and when you're not working, you can pick us up, that sort of thing. My younger one was just like, you lied to me. You told me when you finished your exam, you would not have to work anymore. But you still go to work. So she didn't quite get it. I think the age was not, she wasn't old enough to understand.
That's pretty good at 3 years old to make that kind of comment. Like, hey, mom.
She's like, you got to.
Yeah. Sounds like a TikTok video, but
I mean, you lied to me.
Hey, Christine, through your whole thing, like, would you have done anything differently? What would you change about your prep or your strategy, actually?
It sounds terrible, but I think I'd probably study less.
Okay. Wow.
I don't know if,
yeah.
I overdid it. I wasn't out to win a prize. I wasn't out to win the medal. Yeah. I think that goal is perhaps a fool's errand, isn't it? Going out to win the medal in an exam that's so challenging with so many intelligent people, with so many variables.
I think people, it's an accident most of the time.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And there's a group of, as you said, Stan, there's a group of people that any of them could have been medal winners, but it comes down to the conditions on the day. And you can't control that. Yeah. I just wanted to pass, and I just wanted to pass safely. Like, I wanted to be in a zone where if I was having a bad day on the day, which I was, then I would still be okay. That's all I wanted, but I overdid it. Like, obviously, I way overdid it. So I'd probably just be a little bit more realistic about what to expect from myself.
I actually, Christine, I actually think you can't, like, if you didn't do exactly this. Oh, I don't even know how to, I'm sure there's a graph for this, but you study a certain amount, the range at which you'll perform on the day could be anywhere from a pass to a prize, but you still have to have studied.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm gonna say my two cents worth here is that you have to, unfortunately, you have to overstudy if you want that security to feel safe in the exam. You know, I absolutely agree with you that you don't have to overstudy to pass. And I think you get that after you do the exam, you're like, my God, they've only asked me on the 10% of all the content that I study. It's like, had I known that they were just going to ask the 10%, I could have saved so much time. but I think the risk is that, you know, with that overstudy, you cover that 10% and you may not cover that that amount just with a little bit less. But I felt the same way too. I was like, geez, you know, like I definitely studied way definitely too much.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I wanted to touch on this idea about the conversation about mums in training and just passing, but you completely different. You didn't just pass, you excel, and not just excel being a mum of three and, you know, having to support a family, but also with this injury as well that I'm going to tell you, I don't think even I could have managed that.
Actually, Christine, is there a chance that, you know, having the injury, like you obviously had time off from work, was that actually a blessing in many ways?
Yeah, I people have asked me that question and I have thought about it. Yes and no. So no, because I lost a lot of, like genuinely I lost a lot of time. And I think that on a scale of no injury versus injury, I still had less time to study than if I had not injured myself. Because I was, as I said, I was ramping, you know what I mean? I was in the zone, I was getting ready, I had planned out my last 4 weeks, I was on the go, right? But I think the injury definitely reduced the amount of study that I was able to achieve significantly in that last 6 weeks. But the flip side was I could not leave the house, which was very sad, but I was always there. So when the kids woke up in the morning, I was there. When they went to bed, I was there all the time. So that was actually, I think, quite nice for them, for me just to be physically present a little bit more and to not have to be in and out of the house with work. But in terms of study, no, I think it was a downer. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't imagine, you know, after the operation and with the anesthetic, obviously you are living proof that anesthesia does not affect your memory either short term or long term.
I'm going to clarify. So I did, I requested a plain spinal.
Oh, you did?
Plain spinal for my aura.
Did you? And you were like fully awake during your procedure?
And he's just like, what?
And you're I don't want any sedative at all.
I said no opioid. And, you know, that was a mistake because I needed opioid anyway. Like, it was so painful, the recovery period. And I was, you know, sick afterwards. And so it made no difference anyway. But in my crazy brain, I thought to myself, I can't have a GA. It's going to wipe away all of that stuff right up here. That's all, it's just stuck me here very delicately, just pre-exam. But no, I ended up having like crap loads of opioids anyway. Right. So
I was going to say, it would have been really funny, like during your case, you'd be like, can you please ask me some physiology and pharmacology questions?
Where I was just looking at the monitor, just absolutely out of habit, watching my blood pressure change with the spinal, and the anaesthetist grabbed my face and he goes, you're not an anaesthetic reg today, and I'm a private anaesthetist that doesn't work with registrars.
Oh, fantastic.
So you're telling me that he didn't quiz you? Oh.
He did not quiz me.
But, I mean, for the bill that he charged.
He's going to give me some teaching. How selfish.
But let's go back to the conversation about, you know, that conversation about just mums in training and, you know, I think, you know, our expectations or the expectations that were laid on yourself and how you felt and how you managed them.
I mean, because I've been through, this is my second training program. I finished most of my ED training I sat the, you know, I didn't sit the fellows, but I sat the part one there. So I've received a range of advice from a range of medal winners across two specialties. And most of those medal winners, the ones that I've seen who have been asked to speak, have been relatively unattached men. And so the advice that they offer often is irrelevant to me. So, I mean, I have to say also, if the advice that I'm offering today is irrelevant to people listening, then just so be it. Get, you know, don't pay attention and don't expect to apply things from my life to your life. It has to be relevant. Mm. The advice, and I'm sorry if you guys have ever given this advice, but the advice that I've been told in the past has been like sleep 8 hours, exercise and eat healthy meals. And I'm like, what? That's not a thing for me. Whether yes. or not I'm studying or working, or it's not a thing. I can't do it. Yep. It's not manageable unless you have, you know, permanent alternative childcare options where essentially you get to be relatively unattached for a good period of the day. It's not a thing.
Yep.
So I kind of feel like sometimes the rhetoric around mums in training is that you just have to survive, you know, and mums are just getting through and just scraping by and just managing with, you know, low standards and whatever it may be. And the other thing that I have been told covertly and overtly through my time across the training programs is that people that work part-time are never as good as their full-time counterparts.
Yeah,
And you never reach your full potential. And those words have come out of people's mouths directly to my ears that I will never reach my full potential working part-time. And I don't work part-time at the moment. And I, in fact, have not a lot of interest in working part-time anymore because I just have been a registrar for a while. But I did work part-time a lot through my AD training to facilitate my husband's career. And I just don't believe that to be true. I mean, I think the rhetoric that mums can only, you know, dream of surviving training is far more common than, as you're saying, Stan, the rhetoric around mums being able to excel. Certainly being a parent in anesthesia, but in particular in other aspects of critical care, I just think it makes you a much more compassionate, as for me, it made me a more compassionate and a more understanding physician. It made me a more holistic provider of healthcare. And that's not really talked about. It's kind of just talked about how if you work part-time, you've got to facilitate more of the after-hours and help out your full-time counterpart, then you're not going to be as good as your, you know, that's just.
It is upsetting. It is upsetting to hear that. And honestly, like in terms of some of the responses that I give to a lot of my trainees who, you know, are finding difficulties in terms of getting through the exam is to actually go part-time. And I think they've still got a lot of value to add to the department and to the profession. And I certainly don't think anything, and I think that needs to change in terms of, you know, the way that our cohort views. And hopefully that is, as, you know, the generation that replaces the ones that have previously gone through that, you know, have viewed the, you know, through the lens that everything needs to be done full time. No, you know, like things are so different nowadays. You would never expect, you know, someone like yourself who's gone through all those things to excel in this exam. And I think that's what we need to encourage, and that's what we need to continue to develop. And I think we need to create supporting environments that allow, you know, people like yourself and others to really flourish. And I guess, you know, for yourself, like you never went part-time prior to the primary.
I'll qualify. I did not work part-time, but I did do one thing for a term where I took my ADOs and also took 4 days of annual leave, but spread that out across the terms. So I took 1 day a week, fantastic, like here and there. So yes, it worked out to be maybe 0.8, I reckon, if I counted all my shifts up. But it was, I don't know, is that part-time? Maybe
that's,
it is. But I did
that's
that
a great idea.
Yeah.
So I just asked really good
the
idea.
Roster if I could please take all my allocated ADOs, and if they wouldn't mind, if I could just take this day. And I just took 4 days across the term. And it just because I commute quite a lot, it saved a lot of time, like just, you know, not having to commute for that 4 extra days and those 3 extra ADOs or whatever it was. It really created a lot of time for me. So I did do that for a term, and that was really, the department was really, really good about doing that for me. And I think that's a good idea if people don't want to, you know, drop their contractual FTE down, just doing something a little bit fancy with the roster. It was really common in ED, like really common for people to do that in ED. But it doesn't seem to be so much a thing in anesthetics as far as I've seen, but I think it I don't see why it shouldn't be. So I guess, yes, in a way I did do a term semi-part-time.
Christine, just quickly, was that you took, like, you know, everyone works there for, was it 46 hours or whatever, 43 hours a week. Do you mean you took a annual leave day every week?
So we get the allocated days off in our entitlement in New South Wales. Is that the same in Victoria?
I don't know if we call it allocated days off or whatever.
I'm not sure exactly what the equivalent would be in Victoria, but in New South Wales, I think every month when you work one FTE, you get what you call an ADO. It's an allocated day off. And they don't accrue and you must take them. So we get one a month. So in a term you get three. And then I took 4 days of annual leave, but yeah, I took them individually in a certain week. Yes. And so that was 7 days off across a term. So it's about 1 day off a fortnight. So it was kind of like it just reduced my working days because we have a 4 day working week from 8 to 7. And I found it really helpful. Really.
And you still had some annual leave at the end of all this anyway.
Yeah, I didn't exactly. Yes, I did have leave. And I took, the other thing I did was, you know, leading up to the exam, it's quite hard to get leave sometimes in a good block because of just the number of people sitting. I took some study leave in advance. So I just tried to take it like 3 weeks before the exam or 4 weeks before the exam and take a week off. And then it meant that I didn't necessarily need to have that time off before the exam. So I just tried to communicate with the department about what my needs were and how we could make that happen. I guess the other thing that I would encourage people to do just on that note would be that feeling of being very, you know, like non-present when you're on the floor because your mind is just with.
Yes.
Yeah, like I think that's a very real thing. And I'm sure consultants notice as well when your trainee is just off with the fairies and really isn't there. I used to just have that conversation with the consultants like, hey, look, my mind is elsewhere and I'm really stressed about the primary. What would you like from me today? Like, and is it possible for me to get some study time? And most of the time they were like very happy because they don't want to facilitate a trainee that's only like half present and is going to potentially give, you know, erroneously give a certain medication when they shouldn't be. Like they're very happy to facilitate that. But I think, just having that discussion with my rostering fellow and the consultant I was working with there by day and also the admin person in our department is amazing. They work together to try to facilitate what I wanted, I think,
I think everyone understands, you know, the time and the trauma invested in trying to get through the primary. So I absolutely agree. If you have that conversation with the consultant, they'll often be very, very understanding. And I know that a lot of them will actually allow you to give, you know, some private study time to get that done.
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of after-hours commitments leading up to this exam or prior to the accident?
Yeah, just the same, just the after-hours commitments that allocated to me on the roster. So,
yeah,
my share of weekends and nights, which is not I work in a really nice department that tries to not overload you, so it wasn't too much. And they were very understanding that prior to the exam, they tried for everyone sitting to not to give them too much after hours. So it was good, but it was just the share as per the roster.
Yeah. I think that was the really big challenge, I think, for a lot of the registrars leading up to the exam is the after hours commitment. I think speaking to a lot of them, there's obviously that hospital requirement that they do need to service a department, but at the same time, you know, understanding that it really does, I think, affect the way that, you know, your rhythm, your routine, as you sort of approach the exam. It's a hard one.
I wonder if there's, you know, with a flexible department, like some people love studying in the morning, other people, you know, don't mind studying in the evenings. You know, if you could pair up with the right people, the roster, you know, the roster that you want, I'm sure there's a...
Job share the shifts,
yeah.
Muscle play.
But, Christine, I think, to me, I feel like the real game changer is the fact that, you know, you got the supports and the, you know, I guess negotiation around caring for your kids. Like, it's almost like it feels like that's something that, you know, maybe ideally you could have even planned it 3 months before your start. Like, just all the logistics of that seem really difficult. And maybe that's, the mums that we talk to who have got the exam, essentially they've done what you've done, which is, you know, it feels brutal to have to just let go of your kids for that long. But I mean, that's, how do you even get your, how do you even make that work and then get your mind around that? It sounds so difficult to me.
I mean, it's an ongoing source of friction, isn't it, in a household, that the division of household duties and childcare, that is, and that will never be different. I think it doesn't matter whether you're studying or not, that is a source of friction. So, I mean, childcare, I will say, is not simply the task at hand, but there's a lot of cognitive load that goes into running a household and planning, you know, a month for children. So it was, yeah, I think there are a couple of things. So if I'm not caring for the kids, someone else has to be. So my husband's not present and I'm not present. So it's got to be someone else. So we have a nanny 3 days a week. So we took on that nanny early last year when I started work and had this commute, knowing that I would be away for long hours. And so increasingly when I started studying, having her becoming more and more involved in the day-to-day stuff, so making lunches, putting kids to bed, doing the washing, things that are required to run a household was I think a concerted effort of teaching her, showing her how to do those things and encouraging her to do them as part of her day-to-day. The second thing was, like, I mean, I'm very lucky. I have very supportive in-laws who are very happy to look after the kids. So if I wasn't able to on my days off, they would do it. So I'm not sure what the solution is for people that don't have family around. It probably is just to pay for more childcare. But that was something that we used probably too often, I'm going to say. And then also just like my husband needed a period of adjustment to become accustomed to being the person responsible for managing the household. And that was hard for him because he had not done that before and in fact relinquished every and all responsibility to me when he was studying as well. So he needed a period of adjustment and teaching as well, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you find your nanny, by the way? I know my sister always has trouble.
Okay. Recommendation on there's an online Facebook medical mums group. So towards the end of the year, some people, their circumstances change when they move, so they start to give up their nannies, and so I found her there. Yeah,
sounds amazing. You know, I think, like, if you had if you could sort of change anything in terms of the way that supports are given, what would you change or what would you implement that you think would make the biggest difference?
So I think in a department, having a set day off a week, it like makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Just
a set day, like every Tuesday you have off.
Yeah. So like,
rather than a random one.
Exactly.
That, can happen anytime. Okay. Yep.
I think there are some departments I know that do that in Sydney. And it's not common, but I think it makes an enormous difference to planning a week, to know when you're not working and to have it be the same every time. And when you have young children, they rely a great deal on routine and being able to, anticipate what their week is going to look like. And that, I think, particularly for children that might have any issues with some anxieties, is hugely helpful. So that I would love to have a set day off each week. It would make my life much easier. I know it's not always possible, and I think particularly for smaller hospitals that's quite challenging, isn't it, to facilitate a set day off a week, but it would be good. Other stuff, I want to be careful with what I say, but I do think in anaesthetics there's possibly a little bit more resistance to part-time work than there is in ICU or ED, certainly. Having worked in a number of ED departments, I know that part-time work is super common, and it is incredibly common for people to work part-time around exams, with or without children, with or without other responsibilities. That's just very commonly an option that people take up. And it's hard-pitched, and it's not, like, people don't bat an eyelid when people go part-time on exam. That doesn't seem to be a thing in anaesthetics, not in New South Wales.
Not through training, I agree. And I 100% agree with that.
There are like these enforced restrictions, aren't there, about, you know, how much time you take to complete?
There are restrictions. And there are also in ED, I know that there are restrictions about the total number of periods of time you can take, but it's usually quite long. Like, it's like 10 years or something that you can take in total before you run out of time. So, the only people that I know have trouble fitting their training into 10 years is if they've had multiple children and multiple people on maternity leave and then worked part-time for a period when they came back to work. So then it becomes a little bit tight. But I think if you're getting through your training and you want to work part-time for 3 months before the exam, and it's going to facilitate you passing so you don't, you know, have to put everyone through it again, that would be great.
I do think, like, you know, they've always obviously got this thing about, you know, they want you to have focused time through a period of time to be able to, I guess, have a, you know, get the best, you know, this best trainee kind of concept. But yeah. I guess the thing is, you know, the impression that I get is that if we just went towards workplace-based assessments, really good ones, not just token things, then you could see how much time a person needs, really. You know, you can be flexible for the individual. If they're working part-time and they're not performing well, great, they need to be more than part-time. But if they are working perfectly fine, then why not let people do whatever they need to, as long as they're, you know, progressing well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's time that we want some fun questions.
Yeah, that's good. So, Christine, what do you reckon your most influential book let's start with that one.
Oh, I'm not much of a reader. This is a terrible thing to...
Better yet, most influential TV series.
Oh. That you watched.
I don't watch a lot of TV, but I've recently watched Bear.
That's amazing. Bear.
Amazing. You haven't seen it?
No. Is it on Netflix?
Yeah, it's on Netflix. It's amazing. Go watch it. That's my reco for today.
Okay, right.
I think my most influential, you know, people that just read because they love reading. That's not me. I read and I enjoy a piece that I'm reading, but there's an essay that I read when I was in uni called The Duty of Civil Disobedience by Henry Thoreau, I think, and it's just like a really interesting, progressive piece of work that's been used in discussions of you know, slavery, civil disobedience, existentialism, socialism. Like, it's interesting. Yeah. I haven't touched that in some time. But influential TV series, there's a real fun one called Working Mums.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yes. That was fun. That was fun. I watched that when I was...
Yeah,
when
my wife loves that too.
Yeah, that was nice.
Okay, how about if you could have dinner with any person living or past?
Yeah. I would have to say I would love to sit down for a meal with my late younger brother, Edward.
Yeah.
But if not him, probably the poet, William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet, just because he feels like a bit of a loose unit based upon his poetry. And I think it'd be just exciting.
And that resonates with you, Christine, you know?
Just a one-off. I wouldn't want him living with me, but just a one-off dinner, it'd be quite exciting.
Yeah, just dinner, a short dinner, but you can...
Out the door, yeah.
Maybe a coffee, and then if it goes really well, you know, go.
Yeah, and then we're done. No more.
No, that's great. Hey, Stan, so that's been about 45 minutes, I reckon. That's about...
It's an amazing conversation, Christine. Like, I feel like we could just be chatting here for the next hour, and just your insights and your life journey. There's so much to learn from. And, you know, I just want to really thank you for opening up today and, you know, sharing your thoughts, your experience, your wisdom. And I hope that some of the things you've said really resonate with me. And I hope that we can all sort of listen in, and as we continue to evolve and make sort of positive changes in terms of the way that we support our trainees, and I think just support doctors and people in general. You're a true inspiration. I'm like, I can't tell you how proud I am and how happy I am.
Thanks, Stan.
You know, with how well you did. And I think that really is a reflection of you as a person.
I have to mention one thing. I used to laugh with a friend of mine when we tuned in for the Patreon toots, that Stan would always offer these affirmations at the end of, or without fail, the wrap up of a toot is just Stan Tay giving affirmations, essentially like that. You can do it. You're all amazing. I believe in you. And I used to say when I first tuned in, I was like, how does he know that? You know, he doesn't even know me. How can he offer affirmations to everyone? And then as the weeks went by, we would be like, oh, just let me hear it, Stan. I need it. Really, really need it.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh,
thank you so much, Christine.
Thanks so much for your time, Christine.
Thanks for having me.
So we might close it off there. Thanks very much. for watching and listening to everyone who's out there. And please share with anyone who might be interested in this Anesthesia Coffee Break. And see you next time.